Blog Talk Radio.
Yeah, good evening. This is L.A. Stu. And tonight we're going to Thursday night and usually concentrate on the spiritual. And I came across a couple of things tonight. I think we're going to continue a bit with Swedenborg, even though I'm becoming a little more disillusioned with his work because he is so wrapped in, so laden with Christian it's like a blanket of Christianity that just smothers any truth to anything here, and it's like, and you really kind of wonder, you know, we're not back in the box again. My whole life I've tried to break through the box, and the box that is religion, the box that is political party, the box that is the mathematical square root of two, you know, it's kind of like, it seems like everybody's got a damn formula for something, and it doesn't, I've never believed it had to be that way. You don't have to have formulas. Formulas are trite little conveniences that work for somebody who can't stand to think out of the box, you know. There might be something else. Oh, God forbid there's something else that another way of thinking or another thought process or another person that could possibly think more than, you know, beyond 2 and 2 is 4, you know. That's what Christianity bothers me about, and Islam and Judaism and all these little boxes. It's kind of like, you know, as a kid you get, you know, 4 or 5 or 6 boxes and you try to put one inside the other and that doesn't fit, so you turn it upside down, and, you know, and I mean, it's all right for a 1-year-old because they don't know what the hell they're doing. But when you get to be, you know, 7 or 8, it's kind of a boring game, you know. It's extremely boring. It's in my opinion, it's designed for those people who don't want to think, can't think. Even a man like Swedenborg, who kind of had a chance to see, or what, see, possibly branch out into a 4th or 5th or some unbelievable dimension, and some reality that he could have to find such a larger perspective, and yet he chose to confine it into the dogmas of the church, and, you know, I don't know. I'm searching for something here that I don't think exists, and I have something that from his writings. It's actually not from him, but it's by someone who has contributed to the Swedenborg library. Excuse me, I'm getting over this cold, and but I all my life I've struggled with this concept, and I'm at a point now that I'm too old to care, you know, who I offend, too old to care if I get it wrong or if I get it right. I it just doesn't matter to me anymore, because there's not much more time. There's not that much more time in my life, or possibly even in the life of this planet, or this system that we exist in. And as you can probably tell, I've searched and I've brought so much information forward in the last few years on the show, and different types of information. But I've gotten to a point in my research where I just don't care who I offend, what I look for, where I look for it, and I don't really want anybody to. I get very offended when everything seems to be trying to get put in a box. I had great hope for Swedenborg, and I had read some of his works years ago, and I probably forgot. I was trying to understand why I just did not like, why I stopped reading Swedenborg 25 years ago or so, and didn't pursue any further. But it was more so for the, because I found some of his work to be rather too confining, all I wanted basically was to sample someone else's concepts, okay, of a reality. Nobody knows if his reality is real, okay? It could be completely hallucinogenic. It could be completely derived from a sacred mushroom or some acid trip he took back when his heyday. But, Nostradamus was known to use a potion to bring about these his divining powers, and it's been known for eons and eons in the secret schools and so on, different herbs and different blends and potions and whatnot will bring about certain desired effects and open up the pineal gland and allow one to and remote viewing is not as difficult or as one might think. The only reason people don't do it more often is because they're afraid of it. They're afraid of the concept that maybe they're out of body. What happens to their body if they leave it? Well, you don't have to worry about that. As you study more, you're far more multi-dimensional being than you ever have been taught to be. And to fear the loss of control in your life, that's a very serious issue that everyone confronts. However, by fearing it, by having that irrational fear, that fear for the need of control, you find that you'll become afraid of everything. You must feel some people have to be in control of everything. You know, people, they call themselves micromanagers, Well, they micromanage their lives. They micromanage the lives of their children, their husbands, or their wives, or their employees, or, whatever it may be, because they can't escape that need they have to remain in control of their reality. I, on the other hand, fear as well, but over the years, fear far less than I do, than I ever did. And you may ask, have you lost control? Yeah. It was a lot of fun. I love losing control. It's great, as long as you're not driving, or doing something that somebody isn't, you know, could get hurt at, or you could hurt yourself. But basically, you lose control when you fall asleep. You know, people who are insomniacs are people that are scared to death to fall asleep. Yeah, for fear that they'll lose control of their lives. Yeah, they do stupid things like Michael Jackson. Who, you know, so afraid of falling asleep that he allowed some hack of a doctor to take over his life, and you know, his sleeping life. He was totally out of control. So what I'm getting at is there's an inner need, or inherent need in us, desire in us, to be released from these controls, from these bonds of man-made bonds and spiritual bonds and universal bonds. Why are we bound to this third dimensional reality? It's like, why? We're not. It has been proven time and again. But yet, for people who are afraid to reach out, they always reach out for something else, you know, God, if you will. God's a great guy because essentially God is you. God is who we are. And I've got this article tonight from a guy, Reverend Frank S. Rose. And I haven't read it yet, so it's going to be news to me as well as you. It's called, How Can a Loving God Permit Evil? Yeah, I was browsing through some of this work, and it's an interesting title. Maybe it'll be an interesting article. I mean, barring the obviously illogical passwords, if you will, you're going to expect it's got to be Christian related, and so on and so forth. You're going to have these overtones, but I find it fascinating. It's something that everybody's always asked: how can a loving God permit evil? And before I have not read this, but I feel that the way that he permits evil is because we permit evil. All right, so simple as that. He is us. We are he. All right. Anyway, let me begin. How Can a Loving God Permit Evil? By Reverend Frank S. Rose. It's not always easy to reconcile a belief in a loving, all-powerful God with life as we know it. There is so much suffering. Is there such a thing as justice or fairness in the world? We find ourselves asking if there really is a God who rules over all things. The denial of God does not really solve the problem. It is one way of saying that there is no solution. If there is no God, there would be no point in looking for answers. Injustice and pain would continue to challenge us, but we would have to take the view that since death eventually terminated the game for all players, there really is no point to it all. Well, I used to believe that. I'm already disagreeing with this guy, but I used to believe that. And I used to fear the depths of that a person could actually plunge. And possibly nothing, if there were nothing there to stop him. There were no God there to stop him. And I used to seriously believe that until quite a number of years ago. I found that I could stop falling, right? You fall as far and as fast as you want to. You fail your arms and fall down and you this and blah, 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 and you know, and wind up going to some doctor and he gives you Prozac or some other god-awful thing. And so you're in a mellow mood all day, and you just move along. You know, and maybe you go to a Bible class and find some Bible friend who, you know, spouts Bible all over you all day. And then you go home and, you know, you get on your knees and you pray and you go to bed and you know, kiss your kids and, you know, everything's hunky-dory and God is good. Until, you know, I think one of the kids gets sick or you have an accident in your car or you know, your house burns down or you're flooded or you're whatever you are. And you lose your job or, you know, suddenly your security blanket's not there anymore and your life is just falling again and you fall and you fall and you keep falling and you fall until, you know, one day you go, oh man, am I ever going to hit bottom? And you do. The minute you say, am I ever going to hit bottom? You suddenly, wow, you do hit bottom, right? And then you got to stop there and assess where you are and see if you can climb back out, you know, or just keep falling and whatever, you know, maybe die. But I believe, because it's happened to me before and it's happened to everybody, that when you fall, it's up to you to decide not to fall, or to slow your fall, or to pace your fall, or to enjoy your fall, okay? And go, oh, maybe this is a good thing, you know? I'm rid of that horrible woman, or I'm rid of that terrible job, or I'm happy, and I don't understand why, and I seem to be just falling and falling. Well, I think you have to understand that you're really falling for a reason, and you are continuing to fall because in some very strange way, you're enjoying it. There's no responsibility in a fall. It's like, oh, you know, I fell. I don't know. I don't know how I did that, or I don't know how I'm going to get back up, but, you know. And actually, you don't have to take any responsibility either. You know, you say, oh, gee, I'll pick fall, so I can't get up, and so I'll just call 911. They can come and help me out, you know. But it's like there's always some thing that we can fall back on or depend on to get us out of something, it seems. And just as there is that thing, there suddenly becomes a way for us to get out, that we create that ability to do that. And so my concepts of evil and what evil is the same concept of what good is, right? So I'm going to continue this and see. I just wanted to clarify my own feelings. Maybe they'll coincide with this guy's essay, but since it's my program and not his, and I'm doing him a service, an honor, by reading his work, then I believe I have the right to criticize it as well, or at least question it. At times it does seem as if life is pointless. This is bleak and discouraging. At other times we see abundance evidence of the Lord's love and power, and we can hold on to a belief that he does rule the universe wisely and with great compassion. This still leaves the question of whether he can overcome evil and unfairness. My question again, why does he even bring this up, that the Lord has to? Why does he have to? Why does he have to? Why is he at all obliged to do anything if there is a Lord? Unless that Lord is you, okay? If that deity is within you as a living, breathing person, okay? And in some indirect way, all of these teachings, which I believe have all been distorted, perverted, polluted, mistranslated, but possibly in the purest sense of them, it all comes from us. It is all us. I mean, unless I mean, this idea of this essay was by a guy named Reverend Frank S. Rose. Right? But that's where that stops. The idea of reading this essay on the airwaves, my idea, that is, right? So, am I as equally involved with this creation of this probably very remote, very obscure, I've never heard of this person before, and so maybe this is an extremely remote essay, right? So I'm doing him a far greater service by presenting it than by it being there, right? But for the sake of this program, he's provided me some fodder for my to fill the hour. So let me continue his question. Why is that God seems to let creation go out of hand and every even turn against him? He cannot really say what the answer is without some idea of the overall purpose of creation. God is love. He creates people so that he can share with his love with them. Since love cannot be forced, he gives us choices as to how we respond to life, and we have the freedom to accept his love or to reject it. The freedom is so important that he will not force us to love him or compel us to love honestly, fairly, and peacefully with each other. Again, I buy the concept, I just don't buy that it's specifically God, okay, who does that. I mean, something created us. There's no question about that. There's something has created us physically to be here. And the universe, as we have told, that exists. And by the way, you know, that's another issue. The universe, as we see it with our own eyes, is far, far different than what we supposedly see with someone else's eye, which is through the telescope or through the, you know, the space lab or through somebody else's stories about what they seen. But we're supposed to accept some joker, some guy's idea that, oh yeah, I was on the moon, I walked around, I saw it, and there's some pictures that I took, and blah, blah, blah. Well, anybody with a Photoshop and a camera, you know, can make up a picture. Do it all the time. Not all the time. So we don't know what's real and what's not real, and anybody who's in the business of trying to control people will definitely understand the power of a makeup picture or make-believe picture or a make-believe news story or a television story or whatever. So so all I'm saying is we must be extremely objective as as objective as anybody can possibly be. Discerning religious or spiritual or even physical realities or notions as being fact or being true. And there's one and only one that I've ever found thing, if you will, tool that can be used by us to determine fact from fiction, and that is our own intuition, our own inner voice, our own inner knowledge, our own inner strength, our own inner virtue, our own selves. And if we can acknowledge and accept that we have that inner knowledge, that inner voice, that inner self, then we can put all things, everything around us, and including ourselves, to the test of that inner truth, that inner light, that inner being that exists within us, that voice that we trust, that peace that we receive when we sleep, joy that we get when we see something that the purity in the eyes of an animal, for instance, the look of a cat or a dog when they look at you, or a child, a very young child, an infant, when they look at you, they're looking right at you. They're using their rawest intuitive self, unpolluted, unperverted by experience or age or other outside influences, just pure, absolute inner knowledge. And they look and they see if there's harm or fear. They know if it's fear. They know if it's truth. They know if you're kind. They know if you're not kind. And sometimes they don't. And sometimes they're like we are. They become so overburdened and burdened with life's experiences. And it could be very hard experiences, or they could be very easy, very delightful. But nevertheless, they're extra layers that you don't have as you, as a newborn or as an infant, and that's in all animals, that innocence and that purity. But their survival technique is that they are born with an inner sense of self, and that's what we must always be aware of, regardless of how difficult our day is, or regardless of how difficult our life is. As long as we take a few moments to go into ourselves and find that center, then we can look at the world and make sense of what's going on. Right? And it's very difficult. It's not easy to do that, because the world is set up by so many restraints put upon us by so many other people, institutions, that thrive in this universe, in this world, by doing that, they thrive in this world by putting restraints upon the way we think. Religions, governments, educational institutions, doctors, lawyers, Indian chiefs, all the professions, they all put limitations on them because they all have this, and they say, we know this, and you know, you don't know anything, and you know, if you want to know anything, you know, you got to go through 15 years of know nothing school to find out about it. You know, so it's a fascinating thing to find out that the vast number of millionaires and billionaires in the world and around the world have less than a high school equivalency or less. Right, guys who have the PhDs and the MDs and the BBDs and the DDDs and everything else, DDDs, these guys, you know, never make it, very seldom. They live in their little ivory towers and collect a, you know, salary by some institution so that they can go along and preach whatever the institution wants them to. Because the institution is making the big bucks and controlling the world, you know, Yale or Harvard or the Catholic Church or the Mormon Church or the Lutheran Church or the, you know, Seventh-day Evangelist Church or whatever it is, you know, everybody's got their own gig. And the guys in charge got to have little guys who go to school and study their little things so that they can carry on the work of the churches or the schools or the whatever the thing is, and rather than carry on their own work, carry on their own lives, or find out what really is out there. Let me continue this diatribe here. At times it does seem as if life is pointless. This is bleak and discouraging. At other times we see an abundant evidence of the Lord's love and power, and we can hold on to the belief that He does rule the universe wisely and with great compassion, and this still leaves the question of whether He can overcome evil. I mean, you know, this guy's a blithering idiot. I'm already seeing it. So I'm going to pull out of this, and I don't even want to refer you to the article. So I'm going to go beyond that. Let's go beyond that, Leo. Let's go to, sometimes I think some of the most brilliant work comes out of Family Guy, you know, or anybody ever watched Family Guy. Some of the most... I think it takes more genius to make somebody truly laugh than it does to do anything else. I'm going to skip around here and see if I can find something else that might be of more more relevance to our life. And as I search further and further and further and further, I find that it isn't. There's very little going on here, you know. And everybody thinks differently and has some other grand illusion. Here's a guy I get a kick out of. He used to, I don't know if anybody's ever heard of Terence McKenna. Now, He's a guy who admittedly smoked about 14 joints a day of marijuana, and high grade marijuana, and people started to listen to him, and he started to seem to make a lot of sense to a lot of people. A lot of people make sense to other people when they're smoking weed, but when it comes down to what you're talking about, you haven't got the faintest idea. But in some respect,
of all the drugs,
this is about a 9-minute discussion on by Terence McKenna on cannabis, and I found it to be fascinating. But let me just play it, and I hope you enjoy this.
That have been used by mankind.
Oops, I don't
know. Of all the drugs that have been used by mankind over the centuries, I would venture to argue that cannabis is the most benign. Certainly, more money has been spent trying to find something wrong with cannabis than has ever been spent on any other drug, and the findings are woeful. There's just no support for the idea that cannabis is anything other than as benign as a drug can be when you consider that it has to be smoked. So there is the issue of the generation of tars. Now, it is true that in India, charas, which is what is smoked as the equivalent of hashish, is actually a much more complex material. Charas often contains opium, nearly always contains datura, parts of the datura plant which contain tropane alkaloids, and it usually is held together by resin binders from various varieties of pine trees. Nevertheless, apparently, the smoking of charas in India is also an extremely non-destructive habit. Alcohol, on the other hand, is demonstrably one of the most destructive of all social habits. I mean, I think what a bright world it would be if every alcoholic were a pothead. What a bright world it would be if every user and abuser of speed and caffeine were a pothead. It seems to be a plant which has evolved in a very intimate association with human beings from a very early time, and hence whatever deleterious effects it has, we have managed to accommodate ourselves to them very well. One of the most interesting things about cannabis as a cultural phenomenon, I think, is first of all, notice how cannabis is the resin product of the hemp plant. The hemp plant is, since the Neolithic forward, the preferred source of fiber and cordage. And I think it's interesting to note how the language of story and the technical language of weaving are very, very similar. In other words, we untangle a narrative, we weave a story. Lies are made of whole cloth. All of these words which describe the use of fibrous materials are also the words that we use for storytelling and narrative. And I think it's because probably these two concerns, weaving and...
The reason I played this a few minutes, this is a 9-minute segment, and you can go check out Terrence McKenna on YouTube, and he's got a number there. I mean, he's been dead now for quite some time. But the interesting thing is that here's another example of how we box ourselves into an ideology. Okay? Chances are mostly because it feels good, or it allows us to... To many people, taking some prescription drug is perfectly fine, even though it's killing your liver, or you're creating an addiction. Don't get me wrong, McKenna admittedly smoked 15 sizable joints a day. right? Now, I don't know about you, but anybody smoking 15 joints a day, you know, is kind of like out in some, hinderland. So, you can smoke 15...
Storytell.
I'm sorry, you can smoke 15 cigarettes a day and be functionally literate, but after 15 joints, you can't be, you can't even be talking straight. So it's like, what I'm trying to say is it any different than a guy who's saying, I get the biggest kick out of the Catholic TV. They got some strange news guy that looks like Pee Wee Herman on there. And I don't know if anybody gets that station on their cable. I get a basic cable, so they throw it at you, you know, as a must-see, you know, like something you can't get rid of, like having a growth on your butt, and you got to sit on it, you know. So, but yeah, this is the funniest thing because, I mean, it's this, you know, what Terrence McKenna is saying here in his obvious psychological, you know, addiction to marijuana, is advocating the splendors, the joys, the lack of harm, if you will, or the relation to man and spirit world and so on and so forth. And you can buy that to an extent and have a lot of and enjoy yourself on some weed. But when you look at what he's actually saying, I start to understand. You know, I couldn't listen to much more than that without falling asleep because, you know, he's talking to you in a haze, and it's no different than, like I said, you go to Catholic TV where you see this a fat nun sitting there and 20 other nuns, and all they do is read the rosary, or not read it, but say the rosary, and it's like the amazing thing about that is like, well, what are they doing? They're just numbing their brain. That's all they're doing, numbing it, you know, and making themselves stupid with stupid in the Lord, if you will, stupid in the Word, and it's their word based on some fabricated popish bullshit from, you know, Booga Booga Land. You know, it's like the Vatican. You know, it's like, come on. So what I'm trying to do is not just rile you up as a listener here, but I'm trying to make you see that we all in some way are working out of a box that we create. And we create our own box. It's not really created for us. We create it because we accept it and then enclose it and mail ourselves off to wherever, you know, somebody decides to send us. You know, like in the military, you know, we box ourselves into the military. We sign the agreement. We, you know, do whatever that they tell us to do and stamp us on the ass and jab us with 25 vaccines and package us and send us out of a uniform and send us off to the front line somewhere, wherever that may be. You know, we don't even know. A lot of soldiers don't even know where they're going until they get there. And that's no different than being boxed into any form of lifestyle, that you're not free to decide where you want to go. Because people don't want to think. They don't. They hate to think. People hate it. They hate it with a passion. And you can see that. I mean, probably the most known offenders of this, or the greatest practitioners, I should say, are Republicans and conservatives. They're afraid to think out of the box. They listen to any kind of idiot who talks to them and tells them, you know, it's okay, you know, it's the American way. you know, and that's good for them. They're happy. They're happy to hear that. They love that. Makes them feel good. You know, it's like being like getting stoned on heroin. You know, you wave a flag to an American, and man, he goes into la la land. All right. So again, what I'm trying to say is that we create our boxes, and we must live in them, or we feel that we must live in them. And then we create our homes, you know, and then we feel rooted to that place, to that neighborhood, to that. We all do this. I do this, but again, what I'm trying to say to you is, we don't have to do this and have to be that way. Anything that preaches to me some half-baked doctrines or dogma is not anything I want to hear. I don't want to become trapped in some form of somebody else's reality. I'm perfectly contented in my own, creating my own every day, not listening to anybody's bull, right? Whatever it may be. Because even if I'm in a working environment and I have to work for somebody else or contract out to somebody else, I still don't have to do that. I do it, and if I do it, I say, okay, I'm going to be in your box for this amount of time. I am not going to be in your box after that, okay? You pay me, I can get some money, and, you know, have some fun in another box. Or I don't even need the money. I don't need money. I'm a free agent. I'm a free guy. I don't need money. Right? You can be that way. The freer you are, the better off you are. God blesses the child who has his own. Yeah, well, there's a lot of truth to that. But in the time that I have remaining tonight, I don't know if I've gotten anywhere with you, but maybe I've enclosed us all in one box, or maybe I myself am in one and don't realize it, but I don't think so. And I feel the need to discuss this rather very radical aspect of human existence. And that radical aspect of it is that we have the ability to choose to be wherever, with whomever, at whatever we want to be. That's the radical element of human existence, that we have choice, and that evil or good or complete and absolute boredom, okay, exists if we, and only if we, want it to exist in our lives. You hear people who say, oh, I'm never bored because I live with the Lord, you know, or, oh man, I'm never bored, I always do something, you know. Well, that's true, but you hear many more people who say, geez, man, I'm bored, this is so boring, blah, blah, blah. And the reason that they're bored is because they're waiting for other people to stimulate them or something else to stimulate them. And that doesn't necessarily happen. You know, it's not going to happen. I mean, I do that. I go through television, see if something bores me. You know, if something, I can't watch this. You know, that's how I wind up looking at some numbnuts on a Catholic station, you know, praying themselves into insanity, right? Or some, you know, conservative talk show host, getting all riled up and, you know, all hyperventilating over Obama's healthcare issue or something, you know, or some complete and utter idiot, okay, spouting out who the hell knows on an access program somewhere, you know. It's like It's like, I it's beyond me, you know. So yeah. I mean, I don't. I try to look for humor, if I can. And it's not always there. And I always try to look for a way out of the box. And the first, whenever I walk in a place, I'm the first guy to look for an exit. You know, I do that automatically. How the hell do I get out of here? If I gotta get out of here, you know, in other words, or if I gotta dodge this, or I can't stand it anymore, how the hell do I get out without, you know, everybody seeing me? So, you know, these are things that I consider. Well, but what I'm trying to say is that these are things that everybody should consider, and they don't. Many people will go in to a place and expect to sit there, regardless of who or what it is and how bad it is. They'll just sit there and expect to be to spend their time in prison, whatever it is, whatever prison that is. I, on the other hand, might be lured to some place for some reason. But by God, if I'm not there for a specific purpose, and to spend it in a specific time frame, and not entertained, or not working, or not something, then I'm out of there. I mean, you're not going to see me sit there like some, you know, caged animal. You know, I'm out. I'm gone. And that's the way everybody should be, with thought process, with things that are thrown at them, or with things that exist in their own lives in a physical reality. That's a marriage or a working relationship or something that's totally unendurable. Okay, you get the hell out of there. You don't have to take it. And this is exactly what I'm saying about, you know, we started off this night with Swedenborg, and you know, and I guarantee this will be the last night that we ever talk about Swedenborg. But until we find somebody new, which is always what I'm looking for, another person who thinks out of the box, and I find those people fascinating, and until I find them. Finding them restraining themselves or putting themselves in their own boxes. And we all do that. I do that. So, and I am not even aware of it sometimes that I do. Until it's too late and I'm finding, geez, I gotta get out of this box. You know? So, excuse that. No, I'm not smoking anything. I just have a very bad cold. And but I'm getting away from that as well. I'm breaking out of that box of being in a cold. I'm much better now, later than I was earlier this week. So, in the final few minutes that I have left, what I want to discuss, again, I want to continue this discussion, because I find that not only is it a good therapy for myself to talk about things that I do, but I find that other people relate to those things as well. But again, is my life successful? Not really. Not in terms of money. I'm not Rockefeller. I'm not Donald Trump. But I don't have half the worries that they do. I don't have half the burden that they have. So I think I'm probably make me twice as happy as they are. I find myself to be extremely happy with myself most of the time. Everyone in some way or other. Usually I can laugh at myself. Usually I can curse at myself. I don't ever hit myself, things like that, unless it's by accident. But I can always laugh at myself and always get mad at myself. Those are two things that I always can do. I always know I do them, and so I always do them. And I really, really enjoy both. I enjoy being mad at myself, because if I get mad at myself, I usually produce something from that. And it's usually over some mistake or some error in judgment or something that happens that I did. So I try not to do that again. And I really, really enjoy laughing at myself, because not in the sense that I'm really funny, but in the sense that I really do just, you know, find myself doing stupid things too. So, and when I realize that I'm doing them, rather than get mad at myself, I prefer to laugh at myself and not do those things again. Unless I really want another good laugh. But usually what happens is I'll laugh, and if I ever do that again in the same manner, it usually won't be a laugh. I'll usually get mad at myself again for doing it. So, think out of the box. Always think out of the box. And whatever it takes to think out of the box, do it. Don't be afraid of anything. Unless it's physically harmful to you. And don't go cutting off your arm to feel how it's like to be without an arm. You know, that doesn't make any sense. But what I'm trying to say is, don't be afraid to take the chance of doing things that aren't harmful. I mean, what harm is there to say, well, gee, what if there was no God? What if God was really in me? Is there anything to be? What if I create God? All right? What if I am God? What if you are God and I am God and she is God and he is God? And, you know, if that's the case, somebody once said, some great philosopher said that if man, God did not exist, man would have to make him up, all right? And it's the same way in reverse. If man did not exist, God would have to create him. There'd be nobody who would create God. There's nobody to, to be God. If you don't have man, who knows God? A man doesn't know God. So it's a two-edged sword, this God thing. And a lot of people make a lot of money on this issue. And churches and governments and leaders and, writers and... But nevertheless, doesn't mean that they're right. And what I'm saying is you have as much sense in you as they have in them. And that sense is you, which is your God, which is you. All right? So go out and enjoy and break out of the box. Or break into the box and break yourself out. And have a good night. And tomorrow night we will be joined by Lila and George Dixon. And we'll be trying very hard to break out of the box again. So good night, and have a very, very pleasant evening.